Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving it.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Everyone's afraid. People are terrified. People are really terrified to take any chance or take any swing, and that's the only way to really make something successful, especially in a genre that needs life reviving to it.
With The Carmichael Show on NBC, 29-year-old creator and star Gerard Carmichael is taking the old-fashioned sitcom, complete with live studio audience, and throwing in topics like race and sex. That wasn't uncommon in the Norman Lear era, but as Lear himself has observed, the networks haven't exactly gotten bolder with time. Carmichael talks about the disagreement that led to a delay in announcing a third season renewal for his show, and why he's committed to staying on a broadcast network. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my fellow banterer, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So it is well known by now that Gretchen Carlson of Fox News, a longtime anchor on Fox News or talking head, has been let go. Her contract was not renewed, and she has sued Roger Ailes, the head of Fox News, alleging that she was dropped because she did not succumb to his sexual advances and that she endured a hostile environment for many years. And I'm just going to play a little clip of some of the moments on Fox and Friends, the show she was on for years with Steve Doocy and various other colleagues, where, as you will hear, the focus on her looks was fairly relentless in that environment. And this is from Bloomberg Politics. They made a cut down. I'm just going to play a few seconds of it now.
Gretchen, you look wonderful.
Gretchen, very, very beautiful dress. That's a great color, right?
In summary, Gretchen's beautiful.
Beautiful. You look beautiful.
Well,
thank you.
Look fabulous, too.
Okay, so obviously Roger Ailes favored a certain look, which Gretchen Carlson, who I did not know was like a Stanford graduate and went to Oxford and is obviously a very smart person, you know, she had that look. She was a Miss America, but she really played to that blonde thing. And Roger Ailes, I will say, I've learned from this lawsuit, is clearly a leg man. She had that, all those things.
All you have to do is watch Fox News for a day to realize that there is a certain look that its anchors have. And, you know, the question is, did Roger Ailes create this atmosphere of harassment, and did he specifically proposition her? And he is vehemently denying that. And he put out a statement that said Gretchen Carlson was fired not because of any harassment complaints, but because her ratings were low. And, you know, they moved her around, and, you know, it's a very competitive environment. Fox News wants to be number one, and it has been for many, many years, and she just didn't cut it. Now, this becomes a question of who do you believe? There's now a competing narrative of whether her ratings were bad. I mean, Fox News is putting out a lot of numbers to show that she was, you know, the 14th most watched show on the network. She had dipped in her afternoon slot and sometimes would lose to CNN. And Gretchen Carlson put out a bunch of numbers showing that her numbers were actually up, which they were this year because of the election mostly, and that she was doing fine. And this is not a reason to let her go.
But looking at the larger politics of the situation, I mean, as we sit here, it appears there may be a number of other women who could be subpoenaed, even if they have non-disclosure agreements, to talk about this. It looks like there, you know, this could be smoke with fire behind it, not to prejudge. Fox's parent, 21st Century Fox, has started an outside counsel investigation, which they somewhat are compelled to do. But if there is fire behind all the smoke, then what is the question?
Right. And that's a very interesting question, because Fox News and Roger Ailes have operated under the umbrella of Rupert Murdoch's support from the very beginning. And Roger and Rupert have a very close relationship, and that's a relationship he does not have with James and Lachlan Murdoch, who since last year are now running the entire 21st Century Fox empire. So the question is, if this investigation reveals some unflattering behavior, or if it reveals some significant breaches of the law, is Roger Ailes going to be out?
Now, Roger Ailes he's a 76-year-old man in rather shaky health. James and Lachlan, of course, are the Murdoch sons, and there is bad blood going back with Lachlan. They don't have the relationship not only that the father has, but Lachlan some years ago was sort of brought in to be in training for heir apparent to Rupert, thrown into the deep end of the pool by his dad, and Roger Ailes, along with Peter Chernin, who was then a top executive at the rest of Murdoch's company, this film studio and TV operations, other TV operations, they hazed Lachlan so relentlessly and spun him around so much that he left the company for years, and his dad ultimately had to woo him back. So if Lachlan has a vengeful bone in his body, this plus the health issue and this legal stuff, that is the perfect opportunity to say, this guy's got to go.
Yet, the one thing that speaks perhaps louder than anything else in this situation, money. Fox News mints money. It is the most profitable division in the Murdoch empire. And I think even Lachlan Murdoch would agree that Roger Ailes is the engine of Fox News. He invented it. He is, you know, day-to-day overseer of it. So to make a change at the top like that would be a risky proposition.
Especially now when no one is milking the Donald Trump candidacy more aggressively than Fox. You know, a feud with Megyn Kelly, making up the feud with Megyn Kelly. Yes, there is a lot of money on the line. They can drag out this investigation for a long time. So there's that. I'm just going to quickly note that Fox on the TV network side is having a truly terrible summer, as are the networks generally. And we are just going to very quickly note that what seems to be working is like game shows and reality.
Yeah, I mean, who knew that a Match Game revival and $25,000 pyramid and Celebrity Family Feud would be the driver of ABC's schedule, but here we are.
Yeah, I think it's the $100,000 pyramid now, Matt.
Oh, sorry, I'm dating myself.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. When the sitcom The Carmichael Show premiered on NBC late last August, it was with little fanfare and only a 6-episode order. Gerard Carmichael, co-creator and star of the show, took an old-fashioned format and threw in hot-button topics like Black Lives Matter, religion, and gun control, and viewers reacted. The show drew the highest ratings for a summer comedy on a broadcast network in 8 years. The Carmichael Show is a family-centered multicam show based largely on conversations Carmichael has had with his real friends and family in North Carolina. The second season, 13 episodes this time, aired this spring and continued to take on timely topics, including an election-themed finale that saw Gerard's father, Joe, played by David Alan Grier, facing off against Gerard's girlfriend, Maxine, played by Amber Stevens West.
All right, Joe, give me the best reason that you are voting for Trump.
Well, first, see, he wants
to... And don't say make America great again.
Well, second, see, he wants to bring all the jobs home, and he wants to build up the military and take care of our veterans.
He said Senator McCain wasn't a war hero because he was captured. That's like saying JFK got what he deserved for showing off in a convertible.
You could say that, but everybody's going to hate you for it.
A third season seemed like a good bet, especially since NBC, the once king of TV comedy, has been lacking in that department for a while. But as the networks prepared to reveal their schedules in May, there was still no word from NBC chief Bob Greenblatt on the fate of the show. Recently, Gerard Carmichael sat down with Michael Schneider and Joe Adalian of KCRW's podcast The Spinoff, and he told them the delay came down to one thing.
It was an episode issue. For us, it was just, look, I'm very proud of what we did with the show. I was really confident in what we did with the show. I just wanted a, you know, just wanted an episode order that reflected what I hope is their confidence in the show. So it was as simple as that.
We should give the background, the issue of 10 episodes versus 13 episodes, that from what we understand, NBC wanted 10 episodes, and 20th Century Fox TV, which produces The Carmichael Show, of course, saying, hey, this is a show going into its third season.
Yeah, with all due respect, a disrespectful offer.
Yeah.
It's a disrespectful offer for what I think this show has contributed to the network. I've found it a bit disrespectful.
Yeah, well, and also most shows going into its third season, they usually get 22, let alone, or, you know,
By the way, mind you, not that I entered into the TV business looking for all of the respect in the world. But at the same time, going off what you're saying, like, shows usually get 22, and I to be honest with you, I didn't want 22. I want to maintain a certain amount of quality with the show, and it's so much invested in it, and it consumes all of my time and all of my energy, and I think 13 is a great amount that allows me to be genuinely inspired and create the show, and we can all have some room to breathe, and so that was important. I mean, 13 is a lot, you know, especially when it's coming from such a personal place. 22 I genuinely didn't want, but what I mean, honestly, it was just that the freshman comedies were getting 10, and, you know, we aren't a freshman comedy. And I think we've contributed a lot to NBC.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Do you feel, in talking to some of your peers and other people, that just that whole idea of having to just squeeze out, you know, 20 episodes of TV in 30 weeks is just something that just, no, you don't ever want to do that? That just doesn't make any sense?
Well, truly creative people, it comes from such a personal place. A lot of my friends who have shows and who create, you put so much into it, and you don't want to just do the factory version of a thing. I mean, you can, and there's a good version of that. But also, I mean, that takes people really understanding what the show is, understanding its voice, understanding, I mean, you know, everybody being on board is really important in order to do 22 good episodes. Good? Are we talking good? Are we? You know what I mean? So it's like we'd rather... I'm just speaking for all of us. But a lot of us would rather do a smaller number that we can, you know, control.
Yeah, because episode 19 is terrible, right?
Yeah.
That's a throwaway episode.
I mean, just off pure exhaustion. We would shoot, in both seasons that we've done, we would shoot at times four in a row, which the first, that was the majority of the season, but the second season even. And by the fourth one, you know, people are just tired. I mean, it's a lot of work. So, of course, episode 19's probably, you know, like, it's just off pure exhaustion alone.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, when you're shooting a multi-cam sitcom, obviously there's a deadline.
The audience is coming Thursday.
Right.
They're coming.
Yeah, yeah. You better have something to show them.
You got to have a thing to show them.
And to be fair, you have a cast that can improv with the best of them.
I got the best cast in the world. You know what's funny? What's even more impressive than their ability to improv, because it's actually not a lot of improv on the show. What's really impressive is their ability to not only memorize, but personalize, like, a lot of lines within, like, hours. There have been major changes between tapings. We do two tapings. I wanted to do two tapings because, you know, that was one, that's how it was done. And it gives us time, you know, in between shows to kind of step back and look and see what needs to be changed. The cast that I have is incredible. I mean, there are pages that come down at 6, 4, 7 p.m. taping, you know, and they are great. My cast is really, really great.
You know, you don't know yet. You're probably not going to be on in the fall, but do you know when you're going to go back into production? And do you think that maybe you'll have more time to put the episodes together than you did between the season one, which was a short season, and season two? Or do you think it's going to be as rushed? Do you think that maybe there's an advantage of not being on in the fall that you could sort of get ahead of
absolutely. I mean, just by nature of me coming up with ideas, I'm very much so like a wanderer. At my best, I have enough time to literally just wander the street. Like how Socrates, he's on a street corner debating with people. That's like me Wednesday afternoon, just like at a restaurant arguing about the moon landing, right? So it's like, ideally, I'll have enough time to do that, you know? And so not going back in the, you know, we'll start the room up, but just to stay in a creative space. And then, because, I mean, production is production, you know? I mean, you're in.
Yeah, and I know you've said before you want to be as topical as possible. So, you know, you don't want to be writing things in the fall that are going to feel outdated by the time they air in, say, February or March or April.
Yeah.
So that also sort of, how much prep do you want to do before you kind of get back into it so that you can be as close to day and date as possible?
Yeah, it's just enough time. Just enough. Like, because the core of a lot of these things are really these moments of perspective that I'll find or that a writer will find. And that's really what I'm looking for. And then the references and the things around that perspective can change and can shift. And, tape night. There are certain times where, like, the alts are just fun, like, where I'll just rattle off a lot of really current alts to a thing and just, like, and that can always change. But you just want to have time to really hold on to core perspective.
Yeah, because obviously there's a lot of rewriting you're going to have to do under President Trump next year.
Oh, man. That is going to be...
Is that a segue, Mike?
Yeah, it is a good segue.
The finale was all about... It was sort of about Donald Trump, but it wasn't. Part of it was about that. Part of it, spoiler alert, a big momentous shift in the relationship between you and your now fiancé on the show. But you sort of went there, and you guys don't shy away from contentious stuff. Did you save this one for the finale? What sort of led to tackling this?
Well, it was finding the perspective that I wanted to take on it, because me and Nick Stoller wrote it, and we were just trying to find an end that we hadn't seen, and comments and thoughts that we hadn't seen. And really what it was, and I think, us at our best, and it's a thing that I try and do with stand-up, is kind of hold up a mirror. So more than it's about Trump, it's about our response to him. And more than anything, it's about the fact that even if you disagree or even if you find it completely absurd, part of democracy is sitting at the table with those people, and so it's about the acceptance of, like, look, rather or not you agree with Donald Trump or disagree or any candidate, they are in the race and very much a presence and could very well be the leader of the free world, And it's like, do we start having real discussions now, or do we just live in a state of outrage and shock and name calling? What do we do? And that's kind of the questions that I wanted to raise in the episode.
Are you particularly invested in this election or in politics? I mean, you're a comedian, so your job is to sort of get out there and just sort of, well, I'm not going to tell you what your job is, but one of the things you do is sort of have a bigger picture, sort of what it all means. But I'm wondering, on a micro level, do you feel passionately about these things? Do you sort of not want to feel too passionately because you might think it affects your ability to poke fun at every side? I'm wondering where you stand on that.
It's always objective, probably to a fault. One of the things I like about, like, being a comic, and a lot of comics that I love are able to do this, to even if you do have any personal connection or any strong feelings towards something, you're always able to kind of step back and analyze what it is. So I kind of exist in that state. I mean, there are things that I feel, I kind of joke about it. I have two nieces, and for 2 months after both of them were born, I was so pro-life, just for that moment. I'm like, oh, yeah. Oh, I get it. Yeah, how could you take this away? And then it kind of fizzles.
Right.
Then I'm like, I could see it again. But it's not so much attachment. I'm not a man that's really caught up in the emotion of things. So a lot of times I'm just kind of stepping back and I'm just kind of analyzing it. It's very interesting. I've said this on the show, and this is completely cynical view of things, but, like, the democracy is an illusion, that type of thing. Because you see what things can easily devolve to, and it just becomes fights and chaos, and there are very civil versions of that. Like, anytime we're just dismissive of any candidate, it's the same as fighting. It's the same. It's not helpful. Either you're helping and you're moving it forward or you're not. And so beyond the veneer of what, this civil American structure is a lot of people with a lot of passion, a lot of tension, a lot of anger, So this, the democracy it's fragile.
Coming up after a short break, Jerrod Carmichael explains why he loves a live studio audience and what so many other broadcast sitcoms get wrong. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're bringing you a conversation with Jerrod Carmichael, co-creator and star of The Carmichael Show on NBC. Set in Charlotte, North Carolina, the sitcom is loosely based on Carmichael's own life. He plays himself, and his TV parents share the first names of his real-life parents, Joe and Cynthia. The Carmichael Show has earned critical praise for its take on current issues and their specific impact on the African-American community. Everything from depression to feminism to porn addiction. One of the most talked about episodes of season two revolved around whether it was okay for the Carmichael parents to see Bill Cosby perform. Gerard's girlfriend, Maxine, played by Amber Stevens West, was appalled at the idea, but for Gerard, it was more complicated.
For me, this whole thing isn't about guilt or innocence. It's about the fact that the Cosby Show was so important. I mean, it brought my family together. It made us realize we could go to college. I mean, we didn't, but we knew we could, and that ain't nothing.
That doesn't change the fact that he's a horrible human being.
Maxine, just face it. Talent is more important than morals.
What, more important? According to who?
According to you, the same woman who, despite many accusations, continues to listen to Michael Jackson.
Growing up, Carmichael really was obsessed with The Cosby Show, along with many other NBC sitcoms. When he thought about one day having his own show, he had a very specific vision.
One of my first goals was actually I wanted a show NBC Thursday night.
You want to be must-see TV.
Must-see TV. And grew up watching it and just falling in love with it. I think that the multi-camera sitcom at its best is amazing. It is this real immediate connection. You know what the response is because they're in the room and it's a stage play. And it's really, really amazing at its best. And at its worst, it's just disgusting. Yeah. Unwatchable, you know? And so I was always attracted to that, always really excited about, you know, telling stories in a sitcom.
Well, what do you think happened to the multi-camera sitcom? Why did they become such an endangered species? Just too many bad ones?
Money and laziness. I mean, that's what happens to anything, to genre of music, to your favorite genre of film. The same thing is just like they became really profitable. They became really easy to make. And people knew what it was, and people started putting it through the machine. It didn't have heart. A lot, and it still don't. A lot don't. You know, they don't have heart. They don't have any intention behind them. There's no perspective. There's no true vision. There's no true development where executives really try and figure out what the heart of the show is. We do silly things like, you know, we send it to Vegas for testing, which never proved anything for, like, the comedy. It's either going to grow or it's not. And people, I mean, inherently, there's a flaw there because people respond well to things that they know and they respond negatively to anything that they don't. So if something is innovative, it's already something that people don't know. Or if something is fresh or new or probably maybe decent, it'll probably fail in testing. And I've seen executives read that like it's the Bible. And everyone's afraid. People are terrified. People are really terrified to take any chance or take any swing, and that's the only way to really make something successful, especially in a genre that needs life revived into it.
Well, so that leads to a question. Then what the hell are you doing on a network sitcom? Because if you went to Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, you probably have more freedom.
It's a challenge. It's really the challenge of like, all right, can we make a show for adults? Can we make a show that you don't have to feel guilty for watching? You know, and like, that was the biggest challenge. I mean, I moved to LA instead of New York because I didn't know anyone in LA. I'm attracted to challenges and knowing at its best what it is and what it can be, like knowing the potential.
And in fairness to NBC, I should just say that it doesn't seem like they're noting you to death. It doesn't seem like I've not heard too many stories of them completely getting in the way. So there are networks that are still willing to let people sort of execute at least 90% of their vision.
Listen, with NBC, anyone who's ever loved someone who battled addiction knows my relationship with NBC.
Oh, go on.
Okay, it's just like, no, this way. that now come this, like, stop. So it's just like a lot of we have to love each other. I think.
I imagine when you say, okay, this week we're doing Trump or this week we're doing Cosby, there's a pause and they're probably a little concerned. Okay, yeah. What are you doing?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, now it's, I think, a little bit more excitement, you know, like when we bring up this. Between us, to be honest, I haven't been on a notes call, I think, since the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't.
You let other people handle that?
Yeah, I just don't.
Yeah.
I just don't want to. I don't like the, because you, it has to come from a specific voice and vision. And either you're telling me I legally can't say a thing or we're having creative differences and I trust my creative instinct more than yours.
But one thing I've been wanting to ask you is, you know, on the one hand, the show's really personal in the fact that your name's in the title. And then on the other hand, though, you don't spend a lot of time talking about what the characters on the show do in the world outside of the living room, right? Mm-hmm. We haven't followed them into their workplaces. We've seen a few interactions with people beyond the core family, but not a whole lot. You've kept the focus relatively narrow, and I would imagine intentionally. So could you talk about, on the one hand, the personal nature of it. On the other hand, the sort of the wall you put up between how much you get into the characters. Like, I'm still not sure exactly what you do for a living on the show. I think it's a stand-up, but I've never seen you.
Well, starting with the name, I needed something that was going to hold me accountable. If it has my name on it, you want it to be great. You really want to put your all into it because it's your name, you know, and it's my parents' name. And it's very important. And making it... not that it would ever not be, you know, a priority, but it keeps it there permanently because it's your name on this thing going out. And I take that very seriously. And so that was the reason it's so personal. And as far as the worldview, we travel where things are most interesting. And so if we go to a place, I mean, if we leave that living room, it's because I think something really interesting can happen outside of that living room. Otherwise, I only talk about the things that I'm excited to talk about. So it's like if the job serves a purpose in the conversation, then yeah, then it comes. So we just kind of let it come out naturally.
And that does sort of remind me of a lot of those, especially the 80s NBC comedies, where they rarely left the Cheers bar. They rarely left the Huxtable living room.
Yeah.
You have Family Ties. They're pretty much in that house,
because they stayed at the core of the topic and at the core of the conversation. And it wasn't. They didn't disrespect the intellect of the viewer, and they didn't say, you need a bunch of flashing screens and we need to go to a bar now. For what? For what? You know, like, for what? Like, why are we there? Because we're having an interesting conversation here. Why would we leave it? Why do I need to break it up?
I have to ask you, it's a pretty obvious question, maybe even a cliche question, but I got to ask the Norman Lear of it all. And yeah. I'm wondering, you know, you cited the NBC shows. Have you, maybe as you grew older, did you go back and have you gone back and studied or binged or watched any of those shows? And have you had any contact with Mr. Lear?
I watched those shows growing up, actually, through Nick at Night, through VHSs my parents have, and Norman is just, I mean, All in the Family and the Jeffersons and Maude, these very amazing examples of what truth looks like on television, an honest depiction of a character, you know, and the likable and unlikable aspects of it. And I have been in contact with Norman. We're actually quite a bit, I guess, recently. Yeah, he texted me.
Norman Lear texted you.
He texted me after during I was sitting in Upfronts in New York, and I got a text from Norman Lear, and I was like, I'm not going to top this moment, and I just left. I walked out of Radio City Music Hall, and I walked back to my hotel. Just because I was like, nothing better than this is going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. He said some really great things about your show, too. I mean, that's like the stamp of approval.
To make a great show is hard. To make five is impossible. And he's, you know, it's truth, you know, and I think that's what people connect with.
Well, we're looking forward to season 3. Thank whenever it comes, fingers crossed we'll see it sooner rather than later.
I'm excited.
And thank you, Gerard. Yeah. Thank you very much for coming down. That's Gerard Carmichael of The Carmichael Show.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.